I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are going to have a fun live stream today. We're going to talk about the charge of being a hater. I think it's good to have these little argument clinics because it's actually practical. People can take some notes and get some ideas. And I also hope you'll share some ideas as well. And I have a degree in philosophy. I like to argue. I like to analyze arguments. Richard Hauck, who is coming back this week. Welcome back, Rich.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be back.
Rich is, of course, a newly minted lawyer and a very articulate spokesman, so he likes to argue too. And finally, we have Stephen Paul Foster, who has a doctorate in philosophy just like me, and he's written a recent piece at Countercurrents, which I hope will be miraculously shared in the chat, about hatred. So I thought it would be great to have him. Stephen, welcome back.
Oops. Good to be back.
Okay, you were muted there for a second.
Right,
great. It's great to have you back. So anyway, I want to remind everybody that if you would like to send a question, comment, or donation to the stream, if you want to help out Countercurrents, the only way that you can do that and use a credit card is to go to entropystream.live/countercurrents, hit the green button, leave a paid comment, a paid chat, and we will definitely thank you and get to your question or comment in the course of the stream. We would like this to be somewhat focused on the hater charge and how do we respond to being called haters. And so if you have suggestions as well as questions, please chip those in. And we will definitely take every question and suggestion into account. We're going to try and weave this together into an extremely useful discussion for everybody. I want to go to Rich. Tell us, what do you do when somebody calls you a hater? I know you've been called a hater once or twice now.
Yeah, I have been called a hater a few times. And it's, it's one of those things kind of like depends on the context, of course. Sometimes it's a deal where, sometimes the people are correct. Sometimes they say, you obviously hate. I had one kind of recently. It was like, it was pretty obvious you hate Jews. And I thought, okay, I guess that is obvious. I never really thought about it in terms of hate because it was sort of a, kind of a calculation or an objective decision, I thought, in my mind to me, where, I see all these things that groups of people are doing that I really dislike, or these groups of people I really don't like living around and how they behave and how they've made my life worse in every single aspect you can imagine. And I thought, well, yeah, I guess I do kind of hate them. That's one sense when somebody's like really hostile and aggressive with the charge of hatred. And other times there's been people who have been friendly and they've asked me, do you hate so-and-so group or do you hate them? And it's like in an abstract way, that maybe I hate them, but I don't have to. Like I would still have these views without hating the other groups. I don't have to hate, I don't have really any particular hatred for the Japanese, for example. But I still want them to be in Japan and Europeans to be in Europe and Americans to be in America. I don't,
right?
Because I don't, doesn't hate them doesn't mean I want the country totally flooded with Japanese, for example.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, early on, I wrote an essay called Confessions of a Reluctant Hater. And I wrote it well before I started Countercurrents even. And I think it's a pretty good argument because I was hearing this argument a long time ago. It's decades now that people have been basically saying we are anti-hate groups or the people on the right represent hate groups and things like that. So I wanted to answer that charge honestly, and I think that to answer it honestly, we have to recognize something. First of all, I think, though, that basically people want to treat hate as an intrinsically bad thing. When you're accused of being a hater, that is implicitly understood as an intrinsically bad thing. And I do think that we need to question that assumption. It might be possible that certain kinds of hatred are justifiable, and that certain kinds of love are actually bad. If you love a bad person and enable them to do bad things, that's not good. There's nothing inherently good about love if it creates bad effects in the world. And by the same token, there's nothing intrinsically bad about hate if it's based on reality and it's appropriate, because certain things are objectively hateful. Evil people, malice, things like that. It's appropriate to respond to hateful emotions with hateful counter emotions, I think. And it's entirely natural to do that. So there's nothing intrinsically wrong with it. So one way of responding to the charge of hate is to simply say, well, maybe, but is it the good kind of hate or the bad kind of hate? Because if you can take the argument out of just sort of moralistic finger pointing and condemnation and get people to think about what role this emotion plays in the world, and is it necessarily based on nothing? Does it necessarily lead to bad things? And so forth. I think that is the right ground on which to debate this. Is there an appropriate ground for having these dark and angry emotions that we associate with hate? And are there appropriate circumstances in which love is a bad thing? Because the flip side of saying that hate is always a bad thing is the idea that love is always a good thing, right? Love is the answer and all that sort of 60s pop song stuff, right? Well, it's not necessarily true. And if you just, first of all, get people to talk about how it ain't necessarily so, that hate's a bad thing and that love's a good thing, I think that is the beginning of a huge and fruitful kind of discussion. Another thing that we have to recognize here is that when you're talking about politics and the politics of multicultural societies, there is a lot of conflict in multicultural societies. There's a lot of enmity. There's a lot of hatred. And we believe that that's inevitable. We believe that diversity leads to conflict and hatred, and that greater homogeneity leads to greater peace and harmony in a society. And if you understand that, then the way that I formulate the problem of hate in society, the problem of multiculturalism, is that multiculturalism creates hate. Multiculturalism is a swamp that breeds hate. And if hate is a political problem, and certainly you don't want pogroms and riots and civil wars in your society, those are political problems. If hatred, ethnic hatred, racial hatred is a political problem, then the question becomes, how do we reduce these problems? And the ethno-nationalist approach to reducing them is to simply try and reduce the amount of diversity. If diversity causes hatred and violence, then we reduce hatred and violence by reducing diversity. Whereas the left, basically, they want to plug your ears, close your eyes, think happy thoughts, and basically ignore diversity. That's how they eliminate the problem of hate. They try and shame people into having negative thoughts about outgroups and so forth. But that's not really effective. That's just makes people stealthy, hypocritical, fake about their feelings. But it doesn't change the fact that people feel uncomfortable around diversity and more comfortable around homogeneity. It just doesn't change that. So that's that's an important factor too. If though we give this argument, and this is important, if we give the argument that multiculturalism leads to hate and violence, And those are bad outcomes, right? Then we cannot consistently say, multiculturalism in general leads to hatred and violence. But personally, I'm immune to all that, right? I love everybody. There are people in our sphere who simply want to say that, as a general rule, multiculturalism leads to hatred and violence, but they're immune to it. Well, if you're immune to it, then maybe there's hope for multiculturalism, right? If you're highly, highly ethnocentric, and yet you claim not to hate members of any other group, you're actually giving hope to the multiculturalists. So I think that we have to own up to the fact that if we hold that diversity, broadly speaking, causes hatred and violence, we have to admit that in our particular cases, you know, those negative feelings exist too. We have to own up to that fact. We might not want it. We might be, as I put it in my essay, reluctant haters. We might want to change that situation, but we can't just deny that it's real, I think. Now, let's see if Stephen is back. Let me add him back in. Stephen, can you hear us now?
Yes. I think I've solved the problem.
Oh, great. Great. You sound fine.
Okay,
to
good.
My ears. Yeah. So tell us a bit about your recent essay.
Sure. I think the major focus of my essay is on the perversion of language. And hatred is one of those words, it's one of the many words that the left has twisted and perverted completely outside of its normal, understandable meaning. So hatred for the left is now synonymous with disapproval. So if you disapprove of, say, homosexual marriage, you have a, let's say, a Christian theological objection to it, then you disapprove of it, but you don't hate it in the normal sense of the word hatred. But the left, of course, cannot tolerate disapproval. They are in the business of coercing approval. So they use that twisted word of hatred to say you are a hater. And so basically they're taking disapproval off the table. So you are compelled to agree with us. If you don't, then you are an immoral person, i.e. you are a hateful, hate-twisted individual. So that's just one of the many words, and that's the word hatred is what we're focusing on today. But there are many words that they've done this to. Racism is one of them. It's an invented word. It's a moralizing word. There's a whole group of them. So what the hate speech enables the left to do is to shut down legitimate debate, coerce approval, and make anyone who objects to their version of events as somehow pathological. This has been done in leftist societies and societies where the left dominates, such as the Soviet Union, where any dissension from the narrative is regarded as pathological. It's either treasonous, it's a political rebellion against the establishment, or it's mental health. It's a pathological psychiatric illness that simply takes the person out of the arena of discussion, puts him into a hospital under the care of a physician, and not a person not to be taken serious. Probably the most dramatic example of this type of approach was in the 2016 election, where Hillary Clinton characterized the entire votership of the Trump people as this is a quote, irredeemable, deplorable, not part of America. Now, that's essentially condemning approximately half of the country. So that summarizes a large part, I think, Greg, of my piece. There are some other aspects we can talk about as we go along.
Yeah, I think it's a nice point, a nice subtle point, where basically they're trying to make it impossible to disagree with them in a civil way. If you disagree with the latest leftist fad, the latest leftist moral obsession, you know, whether it's child transsexuals or, you know, the superior virtue of the elect who get their jabs or whatever, you are not allowed to have a polite and serious dissent. As soon as you dissent from that, that's a sign that you're a bad person. It's pathological. You're a hater. And I think that's absolutely right. They don't want to have civil discussions. They don't want to grant that any opposition to their views can be serious and well thought out. They just want to dismiss it as pathological. And there are many ways that they pathologize that, but one of the chief ones is just to say that we're haters, and that's an intrinsically bad thing. So I do think, though, that if we attack the idea that it's intrinsically bad, that is an important way of dealing with it. And I like how you began the piece with a quote from the Bible, actually, talking about righteous hatred. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? I thought that was a good point.
So the this comes from the Old Testament, from the book of Proverbs, and it's basically six things that the Lord hates. And it's very interesting because if you want to play politics, you can say you can attach these things to many of the current activities of the left. So let me enumerate, and I'll use the language of the Old Testament. These six things doth the Lord hate, yea, seven are an abomination unto him: a proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked imaginations, feet that are swift in running to evil, a false witness that speaks lies, and he that sows discord among his brethren. And the last one, I think, is very interesting, because that's one of the main things that the left does is the sowing of discord. And Greg, I think you pointed that out. That's one of the liabilities of a multicultural society, is it's constant discord being sowed by the different factions that are competing for prominence and attention. And they sow that discord by speaking lies, by devising wicked imaginations, by affecting a proud look, by lying, and in some cases, shedding innocent blood. Think about the attack on the Republican congressman by a Bernie Sanders supporter in 2017. So it's ironic that these things coming out of the Old Testament can be applied to not so much to the right, but to the activities of the multicultural left.
Yeah, I think that we have to, when we hear the left decrying us as haters, and obviously context matters in certain circumstances, so you have to check the context. But one response that's very often true is just to point out, wait a second here, you seem rather hateful. These people are haters. They are violent haters. They hold grudges. They dehumanize their enemies. And yet at the same time, they try and maintain this pretense that they're decent people. I think we have to get them off their high horse. One of the ways to knock them off their high horse is to say, you're a hypocrite. Right. If no one is immune to hate, if everybody hates somebody, then that changes the sort of picture that they're painting, because they're trying to paint a picture of a world where they stand for love and harmony, and all the rest of us deplorable stand for hate. And yet their very attitudes towards us is intensely hateful. It's like the argument that you get out of Carl Schmitt in the concept of the political. You get this utopian leftist idea that you can have a world without enemies. And of course, as soon as the left envisions a world without enemies, then they start hating on the people who deny that that's possible. They start hating on political realists like me or you or Carl Schmitt for saying, well, wait a second here. That's not really likely to happen. Suddenly they will round on you, eyes blazing, filled with hate. And the very people who want to claim that it's possible to have a world without enemies have now found an enemy, and that's us. If we can get them off their high horse onto the common ground of human reality, which is that everybody hates somebody, and the real question is it justified? Is it good? And if it's a bad thing, how do we reduce the causes of this bad thing? I'm perfectly willing to admit that violence and hatred, ethnic violence and hatred, are bad things. I want to get out of a situation where those things are really common. And multiculturalists want to increase the conditions of hatred and violence and then lie about it on top of that, whereas I want to get out of those conditions. Let's bring Rich back in, though. Rich, you've been kind of quiet over there.
Yeah, one thing I was thinking about with talking about hate, and you mentioned hate groups, it's similar in a lot of ways. There's quite a few parallels of this charge of hatred with the charge of racism, and even how it's looked at from their academic perspective, which, like, they always call us pseudo-academics, but the way they look at this really is in a pseudo-academic sense, because they don't allow for any possibility that there's a rational reason you might dislike another race or hate a group of people. So any sort of, you know, dislike of another race, if you're white, or any sort of hatred towards, well, they even have it, you know, I was recently called a treasonous or a traitor or something along those lines on Twitter, because I don't even recall. There was one scenario where I expressed sympathy for all of the people arrested at the January 6th protest in D.C. And people were like, you know, people like you belong in Guantanamo Bay. Oh, I remember what it was. I said, if something along the lines of, you know, if you got wrapped up in that, needed to talk to a lawyer, give me a call and I'll answer some questions, maybe get you hooked up with somebody I know in a different state. And then I had a bunch of people reply to me on Twitter calling me, you know, saying I need to be put in Guantanamo Bay because I was suggesting that I had some sympathy for people being arrested in this ordeal. And, you know, where I'm going with this is they have no, so you can't even be dissatisfied with the government without something being wrong with you. They've taken the ability to have some rational, legitimate reason based in reality away. So if you dislike the government, you know, you're just a traitor, and there's no possible reason to dislike the government. These same people who are saying that the government is white supremacist and that the police need defunded and built on genocide. If you say, I actually don't like the government also, you know, but for a little bit different reason, you're treasonous. If you dislike a group of people because of your interactions with them or how they act on the aggregate, you know, you're a racist, and you can't bring any evidence to support your claim at all, even if you have a totally rational. I know people who, like we talked about last week, who genuinely don't consider themselves racist at all. They're very anti-immigration. They're very anti, they're pretty much had the same as we do, but they arrived at those positions without really addressing race. It's like I mentioned before, there's people I know who, or know of them at least, that are like, you know, I'm not racist. I just, all these immigrants are using welfare and committing crime. And, you know, if they were brown, but not using welfare, not committing crime, I'd welcome them here, but they're not, so I don't like them. So the race doesn't even really come into it. It's just, they're kind of looking at how they interact with society on, you know, crime, poverty, welfare usage, and all that stuff. But, you know, they're still charged with racism because the people that they dislike happen to be non-white. The exact same thing with hatred, you know, is if you look through any of these people's, I just attended a seminar recently about, you know, the rise of hatred, and had all these different speakers, a dozen speakers. You know, some people were so-called experts on hate and whatnot and extremism. Some people were public figures. They were either like pastors or rabbis, or one was like a congressman, actually. And it was just, you know, everybody had the same idea when the Muslim guy was speaking, when the black guy was like, you know, these white supremacists, and these, they just hate us for absolutely no reason at all. They just woke up one day and decide to hate us. They have no ability to even like look into any of the criticisms to see if any of them are valid. And that is really kind of mirrors Paul's recent article, where they totally just take this stuff off the table. There's nothing you could say, or you could empirically prove to them that a certain group of people is bad for society, and they would, you know, still say, okay, that's still no reason to hate them. Like, you know, or it's just socioeconomic, you shouldn't hate them because socioeconomic factors. It's always something else or somebody else's problem. And I find that part of it really interesting, because also, like Paul said, it's become a total pathology. It's not a reasonable discussion anymore of, oh, you hate certain group of people. Why? You know, do you have legitimate reasons? And then maybe we can talk about those reasons. It's just, no, if you dislike them for any reason, unless they're white people, something's wrong with you. You know, if you dislike Jews for any reason, you're an anti-Semite, case closed. If you dislike blacks for any reason, racist, case closed. You're a hater. That's it. I find that pretty interesting how it also is, like Paul says, it's a framing of the language and kind of redefining some things there. There's no room whatsoever for legitimate disagreement with these people. And there's also another thing that really bothers me that came up recently. And it was one of these organizations wrote some article about me and kind of had a best of quotes I said about a certain group of people from the Mideast. And, you know, the quotes are fine. I stand by them and whatnot. But the person was like, I couldn't understand why I disliked them, even though everything was laid out. And they were, you know, they kind of meant basically sound like a crackpot. And I thought that was interesting too, because these were well laid out arguments, you know, typical double standards. One was like, hey, why can you have a fortress walled nuclear armed ethno state, but I can't, you know? And,
right.
You know, that was framed as like vicious anti-Semitism.
Right. There's an interesting book that came out a couple years ago by Ashley Jardina called White Identity Politics. And it's filled with, you know, social scientific survey studies that indicate that there's a significant level of dissent on the part of white Americans against these ideas that we associate with critical race theory, the white guilt theory, the white privilege theory, and stuff like that. There are significant numbers of whites who disagree with that strongly. Like 75% of whites disagree with the basic premises of you know, critical race theory. And that's impressive. One of the things, though, that's quite fascinating is the percentage of whites who simultaneously feel pride in their own race and feel like whites need to collectivize in the political realm because there are people out to get us, and so forth. And they don't, but they claim not to have any negative feelings towards other races. And so they maintain that they are somewhat ethnocentric, and rightly so. And yet they claim that they don't have any negative feelings towards other groups. And when I first read this a couple years ago, my question was, you know, are they disingenuous? Are they clueless? Doesn't it seem to be the case that if you have positive feelings towards the in-group, you're going to have negative feelings towards the out-group? Well, I started looking into this, and actually there's social scientific studies that indicate that no, those things don't necessarily go hand in hand. There's a writer named Marilyn Brewer who published a few things starting in the 1970s and then up into the 1990s. On one is called The Psychology of Prejudice, In-Group Love or Out-Group Hate. It's in the Journal of Social Issues. Another is called In-Group Bias in the Minimal Intergroup Situation, which is a very technical, boring title. But the basic point is that if you look at the way that human beliefs are structured, having in-group bias or in-group love is not necessarily correlated with out-group hate. Now, you'd think they'd be flip sides, that they would naturally go together, but they don't necessarily go together. And so one of the ways that we can respond to this argument that people who are nationalistic or ethnocentric or whatever are just haters is, well, it ain't necessarily so, because the social science doesn't support that. Psychologically, it's possible for people to simply have in-group preferences without having any negative generalizations or feelings towards out-groups. And I think that's interesting. I think that's a real human phenomenon that maybe some of our guys might be a little quick to dismiss. I certainly was quick to dismiss this when I first heard about it. But if it is the case that people can have positive feelings towards their in-groups without negative feelings towards out-groups, then when the people on the left just go for the gun, that's, you know, the hater gun, you know, they go straight for that charge or the racist charge, they really are laying it on a bit thick. They really are saying things that actually do not jibe with the experiences of most people that they're attacking. And I think that's an important phenomenon, because one of the things that it means is that it alienates people and angers people. A lot of people think that being a hater is an intrinsically bad thing. They don't think they're bad people. They don't feel hatred in their hearts. But when the left immediately goes to that kind of charge, they immediately escalate to the nuclear option, or what they think is a nuclear option. That's very alienating to other people. Stephen, are you there?
I'm wondering, Greg, if some of the comments on these social science findings reflect some of the research of Kevin MacDonald, who's done a lot of in-group, out-group attitude studies with different ethnic groups. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think one of his conclusions is that white people are among the most embracive of out-groups. They tend to be more receptive than almost any other ethnic or racial group. Does that match?
Yeah, we seem to have the lowest ethnocentrism of the major racial groups, Europeans specifically.
Right.
Which is a weakness in some ways when we have to deal with competition from out-groups that don't think in the same way.
Right. And so I think part of the problem with this whole business of hate and the left's focus on it, I mean, it's very interesting that it's come into the political arena probably within the last 20 years or so with the most intensity. I mean, it's been there for a long time, but it was in 2007 that Edward Kennedy, one of his last great contributions to American society was the drafting of his hate crime legislation, which was passed with bipartisan support. Mm-hmm. So this whole hatred business has come so much into focus, and it betrays the lack of reality that the left has, just generally. I mean, hatred is a normal emotion, and somehow to try and pathologize it and attach it just to one particular group is just so outrageous on the face of it. But yet it escalates constantly. When I was doing a little bit of research in anticipation of this discussion, I found a really fascinating piece on the Social Science Research Council website. And it's entitled Classifying and Identifying the Intensity of Hate Speech. And so the social scientists really get into the analysis of hate speech, and they come up with 6 different levels, starting with level 1, which they call disagreement, and moving all the way up to level 6, which they call death. So at every level, though, there's a threat.
Yeah. Even treating disagreement as level 1 hatred should set off alarm bells, right? It's pathologizing disagreement. Oh, I'm sorry, I disagree with your opinion that, you know, it's rainy. I think it's just misty. Well, you're a hater. You're a level 1 hater. Let's see where this goes. Go ahead.
Here's what it says on the website with level 1 disagreement. It says the first and earliest warning category is disagreement, which involves disagreeing with the ideas or beliefs of a particular group. So we're not even supposed to take a group, any group, and suggest that their thinking, their behavior, their ideas might be a problem. So what we're supposed to do then is to monitor and to be aware of disagreement and be ready in some cases to suppress it. So even disagreement is off the table.
Yeah, well, the direction that this is going is obviously towards some kind of totalitarian society. And we should be alarmed at that. Absolutely. That is what the goal of hate speech legislation is. It's basically to, first of all, they want to talk about hate crimes, right? Because there's an actual crime there. Somebody gets killed. Somebody gets beaten up. And if a certain word slips out during the murder or rape or robbery or whatever, then they can say, oh, it's especially bad because this person had bad thoughts. But they won't say, oh no, we're not criminalizing thoughts per se, but we're criminalizing them in the context of crimes, right? But that doesn't really fly because, you know, if somebody commits a murder and doesn't say anything, and somebody commits a murder and says a swear word or a racial epithet in the process, they've committed the same crime. The crime is the same. But they want to add special penalties for their beliefs, right? The next step is to simply say that those beliefs in and of themselves are dangerous. Those beliefs lead to murder or crime or whatever. And therefore, they have to be suppressed. And that's the direction that all of this anti-hate legislation in particular is moving. They start out by saying that hate is an enhancing factor for punishment. But what they're really saying is that certain ideas are inherently bad, and you can be punished for these ideas as long as they can punish for something else that's, you know, recognized as a crime. But Rich, you're a lawyer. Do you want to talk about this sort of creeping totalitarianism and specifically hate crime legislation?
I had actually a conversation with a mutual friend of ours not too long ago about terrorism and hate crimes. And my view is that both are inherently political entirely, the idea of having hate crimes and the idea of having like these terrorist laws. And the reason is kind of like you said, so murdering somebody is already going to be illegal. Blowing up a subway is already going to be illegal. Stealing an airplane and running it into a building is already going to be illegal. You know, you already can't do any of those within the system of laws. And I find it really bizarre that they are adding, you know, charges themselves and penalties to what the prosecutor essentially thinks was the motivation or, you know, mental state of a person. So, you know, if somebody kills somebody else because they wanted their shoes or their wallet or whatever, that is somehow less of a crime than killing somebody because of their race or because, you know, you had some racial animus involved in the crime. And I think that's really kind of a bizarre, it's a really bizarre addition to really Western law, because traditionally you don't sort of pretend to know the mind state of somebody and what they're thinking. And in this case, you do, and it's politically charged. You know, the idea of a hate crime or terrorism is defined in political terms. So, you know, who's on the domestic and foreign terrorist list changes based on what administration is in power. Those are entirely, you know, the fact that they change and they don't have really a solid definition of how you end up on the list or off the list kind of really shows the naked political, I guess, nature of them.
There is this notion of mens rea, where you talk about, say, the level of culpability in crime. So they have degrees of murder and manslaughter and things like that.
Yeah, you had to mean to do it, generally.
Yeah, you have to intend to do it, malice aforethought, stuff like that.
Right.
Those are relevant factors in understanding what kind of crime has been committed. But to say that, you know, a first-degree murder is different if the person had racist thoughts is absurd.
Yeah. And that's what you're getting to, though. And
yeah.
And that's when you look at the kind of things that are considered hate crime, you know, it's these protected classes. So like you said, if it's okay, yeah, they meant to kill him, but they meant, you know, there was some racist thought somewhere floating around. We're going to throw in hate crime charges. There was a guy who stole, I think, one of those goofy signs like "hate has no home here" or "in this house we believe," one of those kind of signs. Some guy like stole one from someone's yard, or maybe he maybe spray painted over. Anyway, he got like petty vandalism with a hate crime enhancement. So by the nature, if the sign would have said, you know, house for sale or yard sale, it would have been fine. But because it was some like shit lib or BLM sign.
Virtue signaling sign.
Yeah. Yeah. He gets, you know, it's an inherent hate crime.
Well, the other point that's really worth emphasizing is how arbitrarily hate crimes and hate speech is enforced or not enforced. In a society where you have a consistent rule of law, everybody knows what the rules are, and everybody gets the same penalties applied for the same delicts. It makes life predictable. It makes it seem fair to everybody. I mean, that's the way it's supposed to work. But now, hate crimes, it's very arbitrary and selective. Now, both you guys probably remember, it was maybe about a month or 2 months ago, where the psychoanalyst was doing a guest lecture at Yale University, And she went on a riff against white people and how she wanted to shoot them using the F word and how she would dance over their bodies. Do you guys remember that one?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Some Asian woman.
I mean, if that's not a classic hate speech, and if that's not a hate crime, I mean, basically urging people to commit violence, but what sort of penalties or sanctions did she incur? I don't think there were any
for it. You know, there's some ranting on conservative media and things like that. But yeah, there is no pushback. In fact, her status in academia is raised by that kind of behavior.
Well, exactly. And so what that shows is that it's hatred isn't really a legal or moral category. It's a political weapon that's used by people who have the most power. And so the people who are currently empowered are the left, and they can use it pretty much with impunity. They can accuse the right of these ghastly, hateful speeches and acts, and they can face condemnation, as Rich was talking about, penalties and so forth. But it's almost completely penalty-free when it's on the left. So what that suggests is that we're not talking about a moral or a legal categories. These are just simply methods of power and methods of intimidation and punishment.
Yeah, and we should be dismissive of them. We shouldn't, when we hear these charges being thrown around like this, furrow our brows and take them very seriously. When that happens.
It's like the charge of racism. Yeah. You should never respond to a charge of racism that, I'm not a racist, please, I'm not, really. I go to Martin Luther King breakfasts and I believe in this and that. You simply refuse to accept the category. And when someone accuses you of being a hater, you say, well, are certain things I hate? Righteous hatred, as in the Old Testament, and there are certain things I don't hate. Everybody hates something.
Yeah, I think that's very important. Just to say that everybody hates something. Don't pretend that you don't. Come off your high horse. Let's get on the common ground of reality, and ask ourselves how this word is being used. Is it being used in a justifiable or unjustifiable way? Is it being used simply as a political weapon, as a weapon to pathologize mere disagreement with a liberal, and so forth? Once we can get them off their high horse, and of course, if you're dealing with a really committed leftist, they're probably not honest people. But there are honest people in the audience. We have to assume that there are honest lurkers that we can make some inroads with, and knocking your enemy off the high horse, knocking the Hillary Clintons off the high horse, claiming that they stand for virtue and the people who are against them are all deplorable. That's so laughable. Once we do that, I think we can have a real conversation about this. Let's look at entropy and see if we've got some questions over there. Folks, if you would like to share your questions, comments, suggestions, go to entropystream.live/countercurrents, and you can leave a donation along with a question, a comment. We will thank you very much, and we will definitely get to your question in the course of today's stream. Also, any donations that are made today will be doubled, because we have a new matching grant. A very generous donor has come forward and offered to match the next $5,000 that is raised. And well, the first appeals that we're making after that grant, which was announced yesterday, are the appeals we're making today to you. So anyway, if you donate today, it will be doubled. I want to thank France for donating back on the 25th. I'm just scrolling through here. He donated $10 and says money makes the world go round. C has donated $10 on the 25th as well. Thank you very much for that. And now I'm going to look at our more recent donations that have come in. And there are a few. Unknown Californian writes in with $10. Thank you. Whenever I share dissident content with friends, sometimes they tell me they can't deal with the negativity. They only want positive vibes. They believe hate is automatically negative when it's healthy and motivating. Channel hate into something productive. I think that's a good comment. And Gadius writes in with $30. Thank you. Rich described racism last week as in-group preference plus pattern recognition. Could hatred be described as out-group aversion plus pattern recognition? Rich, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I definitely think it could. Because when I think about the people that, I don't even say like I'm in my day-to-day life that I hate them. I just, there's like places and people I avoid and I don't want to be around. And then if I do get stuck around them, I'm like, wow, I hate these people. But yeah, so when I think about the kind of groups that I, hate being stuck around, I think it's dislike of an out-group, and an out-group I recognized has certain behaviors that has kind of led me, or those behaviors, maybe you could add an aspect of it that it's like they're so grating and so foreign and alien to me that I hate them. So I would definitely say there's some formulation there that could probably work on. But I think to make it to absolutely the people that I hate, there's the aspect of like, well, yeah, I guess it is pattern because I'm recognizing that they behave a certain way that is, I see it as kind of anti-civilizational or how I, at least very much at odds with how I imagine a nice, peaceful Friday evening would go. You know what I mean? Well, like they're in there disrupting it. You know, you're at a restaurant and you're like, the next table over is just loud and obnoxious and harassing the waiter. Or you can't get through a stairway because there's a group of feral teens blocking it or whatever it is, and you're like, it's just constant.
Yeah. So, Stephen, what do you think about the idea that maybe hatred is out-group aversion plus pattern recognition or connected with pattern recognition?
I think it's natural to observe out-groups and their behavior and make judgments about it. And as they say, stereotype. And that's another interesting thing, because stereotyping is very verboten on the left. You're not supposed to generalize over any kind of group behavior unless it's white behavior. Now, whites can be stereotyped consistently as bigots and as people that are generally full of prejudice for people who not like them, but stereotyping for any other group is completely off the table. But it makes sense. I mean, stereotyping is just a form of induction. I mean, we generalize off our own experience. I mean, there's how can we avoid doing that? And I mean, when policemen go out to arrest prostitutes, they don't look for conservatively dressed women over 50. I mean, they take certain stereotypical features and act on them. I mean, that's what people do. That's normal behavior. So how can we not do that? It's again, the left asking us to act as though reality doesn't exist.
Absolutely. Stereotypes, generalizations, heuristics based on experience. This is intelligence. This is how we grapple with reality with our minds. We notice patterns and draw conclusions and then make predictions based on those patterns. To ask people not to do that is basically to say that we can't be intelligent. This reminds me, of course, of these stories that have happened over and over in the last 5 or 6 years, where artificial intelligence is too intelligent and it's starting to get racist. Remember Tay, the AI, and basically the conclusion of leftists is that we have to basically lower the intelligence of these artificial intelligences so that they're not racist anymore. Because if you allow intelligence to just have its way, make observations, draw conclusions, you're going to draw conclusions that make some groups uncomfortable. You're going to draw some negative generalizations about some groups. And we can't do that. Of course, you're right. It's fine to blame white people for all kinds of things and stereotype us. But you can't do that for other groups, unless, of course, we're praising them for being superior to us. But no. Go ahead.
Yeah, Greg. Yeah, this whole stereotyping is such an interesting phenomenon. I mean, and it creates, particularly for people on the left, what I call cognitive dissonance. A woman I know who's been a grade school teacher in a multicultural setting in San Diego for many years, who's had many different cultural groups, she's made some fascinating observations, and one of them had to do with young black males. And I remember some years ago where she said to me, you know, when I go out on the playground and I watch the kids playing, interacting during recess, consistently, very consistently, the most aggressive, the most physical, the most overly aggressive young men are, young people are young black males. I mean, that's a fact. That's an empirical observation. And yet her politics are solid left-wing hardcore. So she holds these contradictory beliefs. You can't, all people, all groups are equal. And stereotyping is really wrong, but yet she engages in it herself.
Well, you can't help but do it. And one of the things that we have to point out with liberal-minded white people is that cognitive dissonance. It's a form of hypocrisy. And I don't want them to be consistent with their bad ideas. I want them to betray their bad ideas. It's a healthy sign. When liberals live in overwhelmingly homogeneous neighborhoods, I think that's a sign that they've got healthy minds, even though they've got a certain amount of cognitive dissonance going on, obviously. And I want them to get in touch with their real feelings and be comfortable with those feelings. In my essay, I have an essay called In Defense of Prejudice. I linked it in the chat, which is basically just the idea that inductive generalization is what's being attacked by this idea that you can't have stereotypes and prejudices and so forth. It's the foundation of practical intelligence, the foundation of science. It's all being attacked with this moralistic fake absolute that you cannot draw generalizations about groups. And it's profoundly stupid. I have another essay that I linked. I mentioned it earlier, Confessions of a Reluctant Hater, and I want to bring this back to something Rich said. One of the things that leftists generally do, and even people on the right now ape this because, well, they're mentally passive, but you know, people who oppose prejudice, they'll say things like, Group A who, you know, hates Group B for no reason whatsoever, right? And that's just not true. The way I put it in my piece, Confessions of a Reluctant Hater, is that, you know, nobody hates people just because they're different. Okay. But the fact is that I don't have any problems with Papuans, right? Because I've never met any. The only groups that I actually have got problems with are groups that I interact with and who have negatively impacted my life in ways that I notice patterns, you know, in this negative impact. And that is what breeds anger, contempt, hatred, and a desire to be separate. It's actually having these people around in your own space and having clashes between your standards and your behaviors and their standards and their behaviors. That's what leads to problems. Difference as such does not lead to hatred. Difference in proximity, difference, different peoples competing for the same resources, different peoples with different standards and styles trying to coexist in the same space. That's what causes the clashes. Another thing that we have to take into account, though, is the idea, the absolutely absurd idea that we should like people. Apparently, leftists think that we should like people because they're different. Not in spite of the fact that they're different, right? But just because they're different, which flies in the face of everything we know about human psychology. There's this claim that opposites attract. It's complete bunkum. It's not founded in any psychological studies. No psychological studies find that people are more attracted to one another the more different they are. In fact, it's quite the opposite. The closer people are to one another in their values, but also even in their genetics, the greater the harmony between them. And so the idea that difference is something that we should be attracted to as such is utterly mad. And yet when people talk about diversity as a great good, one of the things that they're saying is that you should not be closed to different people. In fact, you should embrace difference simply as difference. It's not based on any psychological reality whatsoever. It's absolutely pathological and perverse. Rich, can you hear us?
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to add in a couple things from the chat. When we were talking about stereotyping, I made a joke that stereotyping is just remembering which mushrooms made you sick last time. And it's sort of like, you know, kind of true. And I was talking with Gadius about, you know, the kind of out-group dislike plus pattern recognition. And there's a couple different foreign groups that I am live around. One's a group of people from Nepal, and the other ones are Somalians. And, like, they're both out-groups, and I don't really want to live around either one. And I noticed, like, the Nepalese have some, you know, I notice everything about them. And they have a lot of things that are different traditions and customs and whatnot. But they generally, I notice them, but they're generally not aggravating. They're not like, you know, the most pleasant. They're not, I shouldn't say that. They're just not my preferred kind of people to be around, right? But I don't really hate them. I don't walk in and see some people from Nepal and think, oh, Jesus. But the Somalis, on the other hand, are very aggravating and very annoying. And every little thing they do kind of grates me. And I do hate them as a group. So I think that, you know, when I'm actually thinking some real world examples of groups that are different, that I've noticed, that are out groups and things that they do and why, you know, if I had to rank them or if I had to pick, if I was absolutely forced to live with just one group, I would pick the people from Nepal, not the people from Somalia. And, right. And I really think it's like that constant aggravation and annoyance. And I've mentioned it in articles before, just sort of that like, low grade, you know, distrust and dysfunction and them sort of just being around is like terrorism. They have a bunch of kids that are rowdy. They're very unaesthetic to look at. They drive terribly. They're always, you know, in my town, whenever there's some scam of people getting $20,000 a month at some child voucher thing or some Medicare scam, it's always the Somalis. They always almost run me over with their luxury SUVs that they buy and can't drive. You know, and like the Nepalese tend to walk. So I don't almost get ran over in the parking lot by the Nepalese because they're, like I said, they're usually walking. And I like walking. I see people walking. I'm like, oh, that's nice.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think what led me to think one is different, but, you know, more or less I would prefer that they were back in Nepal, but whatever. I don't like hate them. I don't walk into the store and, you know, see, oh my gosh, more of these people. But with the Somalis, it is that way because they're just so, they're just so aggressively foreign is another thing too.
Yeah. You know, one thing I have noticed is that of non-white groups that I've had to deal with, South Asian Hindus tend to be the easiest going for me, for whatever reason. I don't know why that is. South Asian Muslims tend to be aggressive and obnoxious. Yeah, so religion is definitely a factor, but race and culture, other factors are definitely, you know, in there. So I want to talk a bit about some of the people who have been donating at DLive. Folks, if you have DLive tokens, we can turn those into cash. And by turning those into cash, we can keep Countercurrents going strong. So if you would like to toss your DLive tokens, your diamonds, lemons, ninjaginis, ninjets, and so forth, we would be very grateful. Kimberly's donated a diamond. Thank you. Thin Red Line, 14 lemons. Thank you. Beavis and Butthurt, 14 lemons. Stan, one, has donated one ice cream and four lemons. Thank you. Nick Jilvey, one diamond. He says, I'll catch the replay, but have a diamond, gents. So thank you very much. Old Man Yinzer has donated one ice cream. Last week, you had a comment at the very end that I forgot to acknowledge, but I did sort of acknowledge it in what I was saying. Basically, the idea that when somebody calls you a racist, to just ask, why do you hate white people? I've used that a lot, and I think that's extremely effective in certain contexts, because oftentimes it is just because they hate white people. They only use that term against white people. And if you can get somebody, especially publicly, to start going off on how much they hate white people, that's a win for our side. So thank you for that last week, and thank you for the ice cream. Mastercraft Mainframe has donated two ice creams. Alaska Chaga, one diamond. Thank you very much. Gaddius, one diamond. Carl T is today's most valuable player for the 0.05 Bitcoin donation. Well, that's great. He's one of our MVPs all the time. But yeah, thank you, Carl. And Norse Nature, three ice cream. I appreciate that. So let's pop back over to Entropy. Archie Bunker has donated $5. He says, I've helped a lot of other races over my long life and lost a lot because they, especially the blacks, exploit me, probably because they see my generosity as foolish. When I have asked them for help, they don't, unless it's convenient or something is in it for them. This is one of the problems of multiculturalism or multiracial societies, is that people just have a different sense. Different groups have a different sense of what fair dealing is, what right dealing is. And if you belong to a group in a multicultural society that tries to be colorblind and individualist and only give people a fair shake based on their individual performance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, they're going to love you. They're always going to be coming forward and saying, be fair to me. They might even subtly accuse you of being racist, so you'll try and be extra fair to them, right? But if you have anything that you want from them, they'll pretend, if they're smart, they'll pretend to be fair, but they're going to pass it to their cousin Abdul in the end, right? Because that's their way of living. And if they can provide, if they can practice in-group preference while you don't, while you give them the benefit of the doubt, while you give them a fair treatment and they don't reciprocate, they are going to gain power and wealth at your expense. And that is why multicultural societies end up to be full of conflict, because they, especially if they're white multicultural societies, the white majorities are just marks. They are exploited by these parasitic tribal peoples that move in, demand openness, demand fairness, and don't practice it. They don't reciprocate. And we lose. We lose in those interactions. And if you multiply those interactions over the course of a lifetime, and across an entire society, you see the ongoing disaster that we have, where white people are losing control of our native lands everywhere that we have opened the doors to these outside groups, these ethnocentric, double-dealing outside groups. Stephen, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, yeah, a lot of... you know, where even to begin with all of this. One of the things I wanted to, I did want to mention though, to maybe sidetrack a little bit, is I just pulled this up on the Amazon website. It's you can purchase it. It's called the I Hate Ann Coulter, Bill O'Reilly, Rush Limbaugh, Michael Samage Reader, The Hideous Truth About America's Ugliest Conservative. And it's part of the I Hate series. So I remember this from way back about 10 years ago. I wrote a piece for a journal on hatred. And at that time, there were a lot of this. These books were all over the place. But there it is. Just it's in print. It's for sale. It's the hatred. It's the hatred of the left for the right. I mean, how did they explain that without just confessing the most outrageous hypocrisy?
Well, they can't, but they got power, so I guess they just can steamroll us, right? Just to steamroll right over us with that. That's amazing. Red Line has sent us $14. Thank you very much, and that is being doubled, as are all of these. Exocet has sent $10. Thank you very much. And Horatio Nelson has sent $40. And he writes, I just finished Matthew Rose's A World After Liberalism, Philosophers of the Radical Right. It covers the thinking of Spengler, Evola, Francis Parker Yockey, Alana Benoit, and Sam Francis, reasonably fairly. Rose is a conservative, a traditional conservative. He says that the worldview of these writers is intellectually rigorous and needs to be taken seriously because they offer a real alternative to the conservative worldview. A fair treatment shows how compelling our arguments are. To quote Rose, facile dismissals are dangerous. I ordered this book just today, actually. And this fellow, Matthew Rose, is somebody I've been in contact with. He's written some stuff about countercurrents. He mentioned me, or I believe, in some piece he wrote for First Things. He wrote a piece called The Anti-Christian Alt-Right. He's purchased a Yockey volume from me and, had questions. So I think he's a honest scholar who's trying to get to the bottom of the anti-liberal right. And I think it's a positive sign. It was published also by Yale University Press, which is a very good press. So we'll see. I'm going to write a review of it for Countercurrents if it's worth reviewing. I think it probably will be reviewing. I'm looking forward to getting it. So
what's the title of that again, Greg?
Yeah, it is called A World After Liberalism by Matthew Rose, new from Yale University Press. Subtitle, Philosophers of the Radical Right. Again, it's on Spengler, Evola, Yockey, Alain de Benoit, and Sam Francis. So, yeah, I think it's a positive sign. Early on, what the left did, and this is especially true starting in 2015 when the whole alt-right thing was bubbling up and people in the mainstream were getting alarmed. The first thing they did is they just had these journalists write snarky pieces about us, right? And that didn't work because we would cut them to ribbons. They would get embarrassed. They'd get flustered. They'd block us on Twitter or whatever. And people had to retire, and they had a huddle, and they said, we need to task some better minds to deal with this stuff. And so we started getting a wave of books, really starting in 2018, of serious attempts to grapple with the ideas of, let's just call it ethno-nationalism and so forth, that whole dissident right constellation of ideas. And I started reviewing some of these books at Countercurrents, and these books continue to be published. There are intelligent people in academia and public intellectuals trying to grapple with these ideas. Some of them are doing it in a rather slapdash and dishonest way, and others Others are doing it in a very searching way. And I think the best book for us, in a way, was this book by Fukuyama that came out in late 2018 called Identity. I did a 3-part review, about 10,000 words, in early 2019 about this book. And I just showed that this book is profoundly good for us. He basically concedes everything that identitarians want to argue and has the weakest possible rejoinders, including things like a great variety of ethnic restaurants. It's on that low a level. So this is important because honest people, and there are some honest people, even in academia, honest people who grapple with this stuff are going to come away convinced if there's a fair hearing, which is why the left doesn't want fair hearings. This is why they want us basically censored and driven out of polite society. But we didn't go away. We weren't easily put down. And so they're having to do more objective and careful responses. And there's something very dangerous about that, because the more objective and careful these responses are, the greater the chance that somebody's going to say, wait a second, these guys have a point. So I think ideas associated with the identitarian right are slowly chipping away into the intellectual and cultural mainstream. And that's just because we have better arguments. And when the arguments finally get heard, they win. Again, that's why they want to shut us down and censor us, because they just can't win a fair fight. But anyway, this is a very encouraging book. So I'm looking forward to reading it.
Greg, they can't win. I completely agree with you. The arguments are overwhelmingly on the side, I think, of the right. The problem I see is that, particularly now as we see the massive invasions coming in at the border and the total indifference, well, total encouragement of basically a third world invasion, what the greatest fear I have is that we're going to reach a point very soon where nobody's going to be interested in argument. It's not going to be an argument. It's going to be a matter of just sheer force. And we're going to be so massively outnumbered by people who not only don't care about arguments, they can argue, and they just simply are going to rely on their massive numbers and a massive amount of force and coercion. I mean, we're seeing that in South Africa, where we know what's going on in South Africa, and there's virtually no coverage by the mainstream media here in the U.S., but it gives you a sense of what could happen here.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is why immigration is important. There are people who occasionally pop up and say, oh, immigration isn't an issue. I remember Richard Spencer argued that years ago, 2014 or something. It was just utterly perverse when people say immigration, it's not an important issue. It's absolutely crucial, because they're electing a new people. They're changing the populations of societies, of white societies, in order to cement basically permanent left-wing power under a nominally democratic system. Why? By electing a new people, basically. It's a complete inversion of the principle of democratic legitimacy, which holds that the elites are chosen by the people to suit the people. When the elites switch out the population to cement their power over society, regardless of what the initial populace thinks, that is a complete inversion of democracy. That's what they're doing in every country they can get away with it. And any measures to slow that down are important. There were people who were arguing, oh, it doesn't matter whether Trump gets elected. There are people like Hunter Wallace and Richard Spencer who were arguing it doesn't matter if Trump isn't elected, if Biden gets in. And the response I made to that was, immigration matters. Biden will kick the Great Replacement into overdrive. And lo and behold, that's immediately what they did. I'm not especially smart to come up with that prediction. Any moderately intelligent person knew that, right? That's why immigration control is incredibly important, and why people who are fighting the immigration battle, sites like VDARE that focus on it, are incredibly important. That's why even more mainstream, cucky, milquetoast immigration restriction groups are important, because they slow down the Great Replacement, and that gives us time to argue. Because there will come a point, yes, when the country is so full of, 70 IQ savages who don't argue very well, that it, having the best argument won't matter. It'll just be brute force. We want to slow down that day. And to slow that down, we need to have borders. And frankly, I'd be willing to offer any argument, even spurious arguments, just to gain some control over our borders, just to slow down the invasion. They're talking about 400,000 people storming across the border this month. There will be a couple of million who have basically broken into America this year because of Joe Biden. And it wouldn't have happened under Donald Trump, even though Trump didn't build the wall. And
I think, Greg, that there may be an unintentional consequence. It's actually good with this, and it's in the sense that it's just so disastrous that many people who otherwise would have been indifferent or skeptical about what's going on might be convinced that we're under assault. I mean, that's what I'm hoping. I mean, I just saw that number recently, 400,000 people. The Haitian thing was a probe to see what kind of resistance there might be. And now they're massing these huge, huge numbers. Yeah. And they're going to be coming at us. And so it's going to be so catastrophic. I just can't imagine there's not going to be a major reaction. I mean, if there's not, then I think it's very bad.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Stephen, in 2014, Ferguson and BLM led to a dramatic increase in traffic to our kinds of websites. And the migrant crisis led to another dramatic increase. And now, in 2020 and 2021, we have had Ferguson times 1,000, and our own migrant crisis, not a European migrant crisis, one on our southern border. This is very good for white identity politics, and this is why traffic to our websites continues to rise. It's been great at Ameren. I think they've had more than like 1 million visits in a recent month. That's fantastic, or like 1 million unique visitors. It's very impressive. So yeah, last month, August, we had 450,000 unique visitors or something like that. And I don't have statistics for September yet, because we changed web hosts in midstream, in mid-month. And we seem to have lost all the old data. And the new thing that we have, I can't figure it out. I can't figure out what the hell is going on. So we won't have a newsletter for a few days until I figure out this new statistics thing. But the point is that we are being, events are driving people in our direction. And this is a good thing if we can capitalize on it, if we can stay on the internet, if we can put out important facts and explanations and direct people's reactions appropriately, then this is a great opportunity. I think that we have to be careful, though. Accelerationism as a kind of theory, as a kind of strategy, is a crack-brained idea that the faster bad things happen, the better. Sometimes they can happen.
Well, that's sort of a Leninist type of argument.
Yeah. I mean, if it suddenly we were South Africa overnight, that would be a little too accelerated. We don't want that. But there is some truth to it because it recognizes that people learn from suffering. They don't learn from arguments. They learn from suffering. They learn from experience. And people are seeing the change happening. And it's alarming. It's alarming people. And they're looking for answers. So I think this is an opportunity, if we can capitalize on it. But by the same token, the rational policy response is immigration restriction. Even gradual immigration restriction stuff is still the rational thing to do because it gives us time. On the one hand, we want the time. On the other hand, we can benefit from the fright. But if it goes too far too fast, then we just lose because ultimately we win by winning. But we don't win by losing. And the idea that we're going to somehow magically win if we lose our country all overnight to this invasion is crazy. I mean, that's what accelerationists talk about. This Brenton Tarrant goofball, basically his brilliant strategy was to have this massacre in New Zealand and hope that that would provoke the establishment into taking away people's First and Second Amendment freedoms. And then once we don't have the ability to speak out or the ability to organize or the ability to defend ourselves, somehow magically, we're going to have a revolution and overthrow the power.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Yeah. So anyway, Rich, do you have some thoughts on this? Any white pills?
I mean, I agree with everything you're saying about the immigration and acceleration. So I don't really have too much to add about those two. I do have a another thing kind of circling back to the charge of hate, another kind of recent story of kind of piggybacking off one of the other ones where I was talking about somebody looked me up and whatnot, said, you hate so-and-so group of people. And I kind of defended the charge of hate by, you know, pointing out to this person that I found their accusation to be true, but also absurd that it was so negative. I said, you know, why can't I hate a group of people? You know, why do I, you know, you might like them, but why do I have to like them too? Do I have to love the same people you like? You know, is there no, are my options to only be silent and neutral or to love a group of people? I can't look at what they're doing and decide I hate them. And this person was an attorney. And I said, you know, isn't that the whole, like, they're kind of like this libertarian shtick and free speech and free thought. I'm like, you know, isn't that what you believe in? Don't I have the right to think I dislike these people or do I not? Hmm. And he kind of was like really back on his heels about it and, you know, kind of fumbling around. You know, well, you know, do you have legitimate reasons? I said, yeah, I do have legitimate reasons, but let's say I didn't. Let's just say hating a couple groups of people was part of my personality because I woke up one day and decided, let's just say I decided I don't like looking at them, you know? I don't like how their face is looking. I want to hate them. Why? What's so wrong with that? Why am I not free to dislike them? You know, you found out I dislike some group of people. Okay, now you want to, like, police me on it? Like, I have to love the people you like? You know, that is totally bizarre and absurd. And, you know, I kind of turned this around on the guy and – by as this conversation was going, it was to the point of me calling him a weirdo. I said, you know, I think it's really bizarre and kind of unsettling that you, a grown man, are upset that I don't like the same groups of people you like. Like, don't you think, you know, you're kind of ridiculous?
This is good.
And that's where this went. You know, I said, yeah, you know what? I do hate him and I do have reasons, but even if I didn't, so what? Like, you just go around making sure everybody you encounter loves the same group of people you do. That's really a really bizarre hobby. And
it's creepy, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting observation. The idiosyncratic possibilities for the human personality and why can't we have embraced certain just visceral likes and dislikes.
Yeah, why can't I just hate something?
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And I think we are so much now into the hyper feminism where everybody has to care about one another, and any kind of disapproval is crushing to self-esteem. Remember the self-esteem movement? And you know, that's so much of the charges of homophobia resolve around the injuring self-esteem of homosexuals. Okay, so I don't hate homosexuals. I mean, they're just another group. I disapprove of gay marriage, homosexual marriage, but I bear no hatred. But yet, I'm not allowed any aspect of disapproval.
Yeah, last week after our stream on the racism charge, there was a comment at Countercurrents that I thought was really quite brilliant at sort of cutting through the crap of this. And it was basically, it's a free country. Yeah. Oh, you're a horrible racist. Yeah, well, it's a free country. It isn't a free country, and they don't want it to be a free country, and they're memeing it into an unfree country. But still, technically, it's a free country. Still, technically, we're free to love what we want to love and hate what we want to hate. And that's something that we need to hold on to. Just as they are pretending that there's no freedom of thought as a way of they're pretending themselves into a world where there really is no freedom of thought. We should insist and hold to the pretense that no, this is a free country. And that includes to, you know, freedom to love what we love and hate what we hate. And that should cut a lot of the crap for a lot of people. A lot of people will accept that. Hey, it's a free country. It's my preference. I just have these preferences. And that's it. I don't have to justify this. Vast numbers of people believe that kind of stuff in any other category or with any other phenomenon except for race-related stuff, right? People are going to say, "Oh, pedophiles are just—it's just a preference." It's like, "Oh, wow." Is hating pedophiles just a preference? Can we just defend it as a preference? There's no consistency here, right? In our society, some people want to say that there should be absolute freedom of preferences unless you dislike certain protected groups, and then we've got a problem here. We need to call in an airstrike or a drone strike on you. You've got preferences that are out of whack. But I think just demanding the freedom of preferences is not a bad strategy in some contexts. Another thing is, I have to say that the biggest thing I regret in my life is not listening to my gut feelings. The decisions that I regret the most in my life are all connected with not listening to my gut feelings. And I think that we should validate that. And those kinds of gut feelings include not being comfortable around certain kinds of people for whatever reason. And you don't even have to analyze it, because sometimes your gut knows more than your head. And sometimes your gut reaction is drawing upon information that you're not even consciously aware of and drawing conclusions faster than your conscious mind can draw it, and pointing you in the right direction. Don't get in the elevator with the big gentle giant or whatever your gut's telling you. I've regretted not listening to that. I'm sure there are many females who have been raped who regret not listening to their gut reactions. We should not be talked out of listening to our gut reactions and our basic preferences. And that's valid. And that goes back to just how human beings are wired. We have natural preferences and natural reactions, and we shouldn't be talked out of that because of some sort of fake moral absolute about not being hateful or racist or fearful or whatever.
Yeah, I completely agree, Greg. I think there needs to be a lot of space for that type of thinking and that the freedom to embrace preferences, because we all have to order our preferences, and there's That means there are things that we don't prefer, we don't like, and things that we really don't like, and things that we really hate. I mean, there's, you don't embrace everything. And, you know, that brings me to this other thought that I wanted to express, and that's the close connection between the hate charge against the right and the charge of intolerance. Being intolerant, it goes hand in hand with being hateful, which is, again, the shows the inconsistency and the double standards, because the left is about as intolerant as they come. And again, like, tolerance is like hatred. Everybody tolerates some things and is intolerant of other things. I mean, and if you think about it, the left, who raves about toleration, I mean, they sort of embrace you know, a version of the liar's paradox. I will not tolerate intolerance, right? So it just drives you crazy, the kind of inconsistency, because we're all intolerant, and we should be intolerant of things, certain things.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that too. You know, there are certain contexts. I suppose, you know, religious tolerance is sort of a hard won right that we have in America. That's a good thing. Do you tolerate anything in your own household, though? No. Basically anything that's flagrantly evil or harmful to society, we shouldn't be tolerant of that. We shouldn't be tolerant of crime. We shouldn't be tolerant of terrorism. And we shouldn't be tolerant of riots and pretend like this is just freedom of speech and a difference of opinion as they burn down buildings and loot shoe stores. So yeah, I do think that the tolerance charge or the intolerance charge is related to the hate charge, definitely. But I think that we can defend certain forms of intolerance too. So, Rich, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, the intolerance thing that Paul is bringing about is, I think Karl Popper came up with that, like the paradox of tolerance, about how you have to, you know, is this really circular thing about how you can't, you have to be intolerant of intolerance, or else the you know, tolerance within society gets eroded. He was a Jewish guy, and it was a very Jewish argument. And it was basically saying, you know, we're allowed to hate you in your culture, but you can't hate us in our culture. And this is how we're going to rationalize it.
Right. And
yes, the intolerance thing is intolerance is a very sneaky thing, because they take something that could maybe be useful, you know, having some tolerance and patience for your kids and your family and your friends and your elderly parents, and like, you know, slowing down and realizing everybody's not perfect and you have some differences and that kind of thing. And then them taking it to this extreme of, you know, if you aren't supporting the dude in a dress and makeup running around trying to teach little kids about sexuality, you're a bigot. And if you don't, you know, support whatever Black Lives Matter is doing, you're intolerant. And if you don't support your neighborhood being radically altered by Afghans, you're intolerant. And they just take this, it's kind of a sneaky little trick they do. Like, they take something that is probably a decent trait to have in a normal homogenous society. If it was like an all white society and they said, oh, you know, that guy's pretty patient, he's pretty pretty tolerant guy, you think like, okay, he's like well-mannered, has a cool temper. He's a solid guy, not very neurotic, not back and forth. He's just, you know, he kind of goes with the flow. Like, that's a cool guy. You know what I mean? Those are all good traits to have in a man. But then, you know, there's this like shit-lib soy cuck version of tolerance where it's like, oh, Tyrone wants to fuck my wife. Yeah, I'm totally open and tolerant to that. And, you know, yeah, they want me to eat the bugs. Fuck it, I'm tolerant. I'm going to try the bug sandwich, you know? It's right out of Israel. It's delicious. You know, that now it just perverted and extreme. They take something that, like I said, could have been in some other time an admirable trait and just made it so insane. Yeah, somebody said in the comment, they want to tolerate your own genocide. Yeah, tolerate your own replacement. Just please sit down and don't make a fuss while we, you know, radically alter everything your ancestors have ever done, everything you ever wanted. And that's what they sell is tolerance now.
Yeah, well, yeah. Well, tolerance is not having standards anymore.
Yeah, no standards.
Yeah.
Well, that's the, you know, see, that's where we're going more and more with the hate approach and the intolerant accusations of the left, and it's increasingly moving to a society of intense coercive moralism where people are basically bullied and brutalized into embracing things that they don't approve of, things that they dislike, things in some cases that they hate, but they're, it's this coercive morality, and if you dissent from it, then you're demoralized. So then you're a hater, you're intolerant, you're a bigot, all of these things. And it's just so, in a way, it's so obvious what's going on. And why so many people are caving into it is one of those things that I just can't get my head around.
Yeah, the tolerance issue, I think, is fascinating. The way I put it is this. The left basically uses tolerance as a way of undermining standards. And my attitude towards tolerance is the following. I think it's completely completely consistent with standards. I uphold certain standards. I have fairly high standards of what's normal and right and decent. And if you want to uphold high standards, then you're going to have to recognize the fact that human beings, being what they are, being human, all too human, are going to fail to meet those standards. And I would rather just have a certain amount of tolerance for human, all too human failure to meet standards than erase standards in the name of quote-unquote tolerance. And that I think is crucial. You cannot have a functioning society without standards. You simply can't do it. And to say, we have to be tolerant of everyone, so let's erase all the standards by which they are judged lacking, right? Basically, you're saying that you can't let anybody feel bad about himself anymore. And how can we prevent people from feeling bad about themselves? Well, we just eliminate all standards by which they can be judged. Well, yeah, that basically eliminates bad feelings on the part of misbehaving or substandard or abnormal people, right? But you can't have a society without standards. You simply can't do that. You can't have excellence without standards.
Greg, Patrick Moynihan, maybe 30, 40 years ago, came out with the concept of defining deviancy down, which centers just on what you're talking about. And the idea that the standards we uphold for society have been eroded over the years. The example he gave was the St. Valentine's Massacre in 1927, which shocked the world, what multiple murder. And now every weekend in many of the major cities, we have multiple St. Valentine's massacres in terms of numbers, and nobody, you know, they don't even make the front page or back page news. Nobody cares.
It's just the new normal, defining
deviancy down.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so I think that a certain amount of tolerance in a sense is necessary if you uphold high standards. The higher your standards, the more people who are going to fail to meet them. But it's so important to maintain those standards that I would rather be tolerant of the people who fail to meet them than to lower standards so that more people are successful. You can't have striving for excellence if you don't have standards. You just have mediocrity, and that's really the purpose of a lot of this sort of leftist crusade against low self-esteem, against intolerance, against standards. Basically, anything that makes people feel bad about themselves has to be gotten rid of. Well, what is that basically doing? It's taking away any incentive for people to do anything with their lives, to do anything to improve their lives. You're good enough just the way you are. That is just a recipe for stagnation and mediocrity. So let's check in at Entropy and see if we have some new questions and comments here. Scott has written in with $3. Thank you very much. I was called racist recently, and I just replied, of course I'm racist, I'm white, and I don't hate myself. That's all racism is now. And the person accusing me of racism begrudgingly agreed. Yeah, well, that's basically correct, and I'm glad you did it. And it's funny sometimes how just a little bit of pushback will cause these people to retreat or just drop it. Because this guy probably doesn't sincerely believe this stuff, but he thought he had one on you. He thought, well, you know, we can use this cheap cudgel to get our way with people. Everyone will bow down, and avoid the charge. And when you didn't do that, well, he just dropped it. So yeah, a little bit of pushback is a good thing. And we should try pushing back. We should all try pushing back against this bullying, because that's really what it is. It's bullying. Another thing that we should do as a response to this charge of hater or racist or whatever is just to say, I'm sorry, this is just bullying. I'm not going to be bullied by you. It's a free country. I'm not going to be bullied by you. I think that's good. One thing I really like about Amy Therese recently, she's my favorite leftist on Twitter, especially now that Sean McCarthy's gone. But she emphasizes how a lot of the moralistic discourse of the left is just a form of bullying, intimidation and bullying. And a lot of it's incredibly nasty. A lot of these people are gleefully, transparently sadistic and nasty. And just calling them out on that, I think, is an important step towards destroying, you know, just destroying their power, basically. So let's check with our DLive tokens and see if we've got some more of those. Norse Nature has donated 3 ice cream. Michael has donated 3 ice cream. Mastercraft Mainframe has donated 1 ice cream. Spartan Superior, 1 lemon. Alaska Chaga, 1 diamond. Thank you. Slog has donated 14 lemons. And Spartan Superior has donated 3 lemons. Okay, so folks, if there's anyone out there in the DLive chat who has some thoughts and comments about how to respond to this charge, this hater charge, we'd love to hear from you. Let's get your 2 bits in. Rich, do you have any further thoughts on this?
No, I think about wraps up for all the notes I had and everything we wanted to get in there.
Well, great. What about you, Stephen?
Yeah, there is one further thing that I wanted to mention that really hasn't come in too much in the conversation that we've had this afternoon, and that is what's going on in Europe with hate speech and hate crimes. And if we look in Germany and France and basically Western Europe and Scandinavia, it's not a good outlook for us. They're way ahead of us. Canada too, by the way. They're way ahead of us in shutting down free speech, in prosecuting people for expressing simply opinions that are disapprove of other groups. In some cases, relatively mild disapproval. In France, you can. My understanding is that you can be prosecuted for having doubts about the immigration of Muslims. You can be prosecuted for incited hatred. Here again, hatred. So we haven't talked. We haven't said a lot about that, but that's another phenomenon I think we have to look at very carefully and hope we can see some signs of pushback in Europe coming from the right to, that will counteract that.
Yeah, I do think that one white pill about Europe, though, is that even though they have much worse hate speech laws than America, first of all, in America, we have just as much censorship, and it's just privately done. We've got these private corporations bullying people, censoring people, and doing it openly to affect elections, right? Whereas in countries like France, for instance, you can't be fired from your job for your political opinions. It's not legal to do that. So there are countries in Europe where people have greater protection from private organizations, corporations, businesses, whatever, from censoring you or punishing you for your political views. But they do have more public laws on the books for censorship, and that is a problem. However, that hasn't stopped the right from being bigger in France, for instance, than in practically any other Western European country. I mean, the people who are considered far right were in the runoffs in the last two presidential elections. That's important. They have more than a third of the electorate on their side, and that's tremendous. So it hasn't stopped them. It really hasn't stopped them. And there are some countervailing things in place. So I think that the situation in Europe isn't quite as bad as we fear. It hasn't stopped the right from growing tremendously and being far ahead in terms of organization and representation in government than anything comparable in the Anglosphere, for instance.
Yeah, we see that. I guess the other hopeful thing about Europe is Eastern Europe, countries like Hungary, where the multiculturalism is much more resisted. The immigration is much more resisted, and I think those are really hopeful signs that maybe it's possible that this avalanche is going to some point subside.
Yeah, I agree. I think that countries like Hungary, Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, they're standing fairly firm against multiculturalism and refugee resettlement and so forth. They're also reaching a point now where under the EU budget, I think in the next EU budget cycle, all of these countries are going to be asked to contribute more money into the EU than they're getting out of the EU. And I think that's going to change the attitudes of a lot of people in those countries, because those countries, Poland was never a very developed part of Europe. And then the Second World War was absolutely devastating to Poland. And then they had decades of communism. And then they got their republic back, and they became a Western society. And when they joined the EU basically built extraordinarily good infrastructure in Poland. I remember a few years ago, the first time I visited Poland, I was also in Germany around that time. And the infrastructure in Germany was appalling. It was covered with graffiti. It was breaking down. And Poland, it was full of beautiful roads and bridges, and everything looked brand spanking new. And this is the EU's doing. So a lot of these countries have gotten amazingly good development aid from the EU. That balance is going to change, and they're going to be asked to contribute more to countries like Bulgaria than they're getting from countries like Germany. And then that is going to knock one of the props keeping these countries in the EU out. And I think that combined with the EU's pushing very bad policies might induce Poland and Hungary and some of these other countries to finally leave. And I think that would be a good thing. Either they'll leave and maintain their identity, or they'll maintain their identity in the EU and the EU will be forced to accommodate them. But I don't think they're going to lose out to the EU pushing diversity and multiculturalism, and that's a good thing. So anyway, we are running out of time, folks. So Rich, can you tell us a little bit about the work that you've got coming up so people can follow you and you know, see more Rich Hauck?
Yeah, the couple things I am working on right now. There's two articles that are a continuation of the War Against Whites series. And one is about white children, and the other one is about white neighborhoods. And it'll deal with sort of, you know, you can look around and see some of these neighborhoods are terrible. I was recently in a neighborhood where my dad grew up. It was all white when he grew up, and now there's like African supermarkets and Mexican supermarkets and totally non-white now. Mm-hmm. So I want to kind of look at some things like that and trace it back to some of the laws and Supreme Court cases that got us there. Do the same kind of thing with the war against white children. I actually interviewed a handful of people, like younger white people that are in high school age, a couple from like a really diverse school, a couple from an all-white school, kind of talk about the differences there. And then I have this article I'm working on. I mentioned it last week about the witch trials and some interesting connections there. I want to try to get that out for like around Halloween.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I'm excited about that.
So that's, those are the articles I have kind of cooking up right now.
Yeah. So if you want to follow Rich, his Linktree address is scrolling across the bottom. So just jot that down, copy, paste, or whatever. And Stephen, what do we have to look forward to from you? What are you working on now?
Well, I have some things percolating in my mind. I would like to do something with the theme of intolerance as a adjacency to the hate speech, because I think they're very related, and there's a lot of interesting argumentation that can be teased out of those things. So that's, I guess that's the main thing I'm working on. I'm also have some thoughts percolating about a new novel, a third novel that I'm hoping to get started on.
That's great. We need to get a review of your second novel up at Countercurrents, and I will definitely work on that this week. So, folks, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Rich, for a good conversation. Thank you, thanks, the 200-plus people out there in the audience who have been with us. I want to thank the donors especially and the moderators, people like Gadius and Bartleby. You're all great. We will be back with another episode of Countercurrents Radio next Saturday, but tune in tomorrow and you can listen to the Writer's Block with Nicholas Gilvey. And tomorrow, Nick is going to have Bo Albrecht on, who's a very popular Countercurrents writer. And they're going to look back at the best at Countercurrents in the last month. So they're going to be looking back at September. And this is something that Nick is planning to do every month. He's going to have a sort of roundup best of the previous month Countercurrents show. So anyway, that'll be the Writer's Block, which will be in this channel. And it will start at 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. And you can do the math for the other time zones. That'll be 4 o'clock, 4 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, 1 o'clock Pacific Time. So folks, we will be back 1 week from today with another Countercurrents Radio live stream, and tune in tomorrow for the Writer's Block.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Greg. Nice to talk to you, Rich.
See you guys. Thank you.
Yep. Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.